You're with The Record on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. George Bush and Dick Cheney, they ran the country for 8 years, guided the nation through the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. They launched a Middle East war that's now the longest we've ever endured, and they enacted fiscal policies that wound up contributing to the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. In his new book, Days of Fire, New York Times White House correspondent Peter Baker chronicles the Bush-Cheney administration, and along the way, he dismantles some of the myths that surrounded that White House. Peter Baker joins me. It's great to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Before George Bush decided that Dick Cheney was going to be his running mate, what was the relationship between these two men?
Well, they didn't know each other very well. Cheney, of course, had been his father's defense secretary. But he had had some respect for him back in 1992 when his dad was running for re-election. George W. Bush actually urged him to dump Dan Quayle from the ticket and put on his defense secretary, of course, Dick Cheney. So he had this idea, as he put it, of a Bush-Cheney ticket even earlier than 2000.
A different Bush.
A different Bush.
Same
right?
Cheney.
Yeah.
Dick Cheney, it seems like, from your description, is a guy who was a mystery even to his colleagues in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, he was. A little bit of a black box. He would sit in meetings with Bush and the team, and they'd have conversations. And from the outside, you'd kind of imagine that Cheney would be a pretty vocal person there. We know he's strong-willed, has a lot of ideas. But in fact, he didn't really say very much in these meetings. And people would walk out of the meeting scratching their heads, not knowing where he came from. But what they noticed was when they walked out, he stayed behind. And that's when he exercises influence with the president.
He had originally been brought on by Bush before he was President Bush to vet vice presidential candidates. I think a lot of people have the cynical idea that he maneuvered himself into that position because he wanted the job. That is myth number one that you're going to dispel.
Well, that is. I mean, that's not the full story in any case, because Bush did send his aide, Joe Alba, to meet with Cheney before the search committee idea and asked him to be on the ticket. And Cheney said no initially. So the search committee was kind of like a next step. Let's try that. And obviously over those few months, you know, Bush turned to Cheney as opposed to anybody else. And some friends still do believe that Cheney, you know, kind of like shaped that process in a way that ultimately did lead to him.
A lot of people do see Dick Cheney as a sort of Svengali to Bush's czar.
Right.
How much truth is there to that?
Well, I think that's sort of where we go a little far sometimes. The cartoonish version, he's the puppet master and Bush is the puppet. No question. He was the most influential vice president we've ever had, particularly in the early days. And he understood how power worked. He understood how the White House worked. But Bush gave him that authority, empowered him. And he, as General Myers, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said, Bush was the alpha male in the White House.
But the Dick Cheney that came with George Bush, despite the fact that he was quiet or maybe seemed like a black box, the man that you describe is somebody who, I'm not sure if paranoia is the right word to describe him, but he had a very interesting sense of the United States vis-a-vis the rest of the world.
Yeah, he had a dark view of a dangerous world. And he had, long before 9/11, he had participated in these exercises pretending a nuclear war had happened and he would be spirited off. And then he was very obsessed with what he called bugs and gas. So by the time 9/11 comes along, it confirms to him this idea that there are threats out there of a great nature. And he focuses on this, in fact, for the rest of that 8 years there in office, even when other people begin to move on to other issues.
He really was a foreign policy guy. I mean, I know he had some domestic policy things that he pushed, but it seems to me, at least in the first term of this administration, that his power was experience that he had in foreign policy, which a governor of a state, no matter what state it is, doesn't really have. And that power, it seems like from your book, was what he was able to exert in the way that George Bush in the first term interacted with the rest of the world.
Absolutely. No, he's the one who is the guide after 9/11 as to where Bush is to go. He's the one who takes the military commission's order and circumvents Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, takes it to Bush for his signature directly. And Bush wants him to do this. I mean, the thing is, what I think people go wrong is thinking that was somehow convincing Bush to do something he didn't want to do. I think Cheney was pushing on open doors. And I interviewed 275 people, and nobody told me that Bush ever said to them that Cheney convinced him to do something he didn't want to do. There were times, in fact, he actually did push back against Cheney.
Well, it was an interesting triangle in that first administration, because Condoleezza Rice, she didn't have a seat at the cabinet table, if there is such a thing. And it seemed like her relationship with Cheney was really complicated, even though she is acknowledged to be a brilliant woman.
Yes, no, exactly. She had a very scratchy relationship with Rumsfeld, Cheney's friend, very tense with Cheney at times. And look at what she was asked to manage as national security advisor, a vice president who had been defense secretary, who had been a longtime member of Congress and White House chief of staff, a defense secretary who had been defense secretary in another administration and White House chief of staff and a member of Congress, and a secretary of state, Colin Powell, who had been had her job and had also been chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And so she was asked to sort of wrestle these 800-pound gorillas to the ground as they're busy fighting among each other. It was a big challenge.
You also describe Cheney as having, in addition to his sort of dark view of the rest of the world, a very conservative politic, maybe more conservative than people thought from looking at him from the outside.
I think people misunderstood Cheney. He was always, in fact, pretty conservative. Back to the Ford days when he was chief of staff, he was the one who helped get Nelson Rockefeller off the ticket. He wanted to put Reagan on. During Bush 43, he was very skeptical of the Soviet Union reforms Gorbachev was putting in place. He just had a more low-key, moderate demeanor. When he went on television, he didn't come across as bombastic the way, say, Newt Gingrich did. But he had the same kind of voting record. And when Bush looks at him for vice president, Cheney says, look, here are some reasons you ought not to think about me. One of them is I'm very conservative. And Bush says, yeah, Dick, we know that. And Cheney says, no, I'm very conservative.
What about Colin Powell? Was he very conservative?
No, Powell wasn't. And he at one point, in fact, he jokingly refers to Cheney as a right-wing nut. They had their differences even in the Bush 41 administration. By the Bush 43 administration, Powell was kind of left out of the main decision making, because Cheney is more in sync with President Bush 43 than Powell is.
Months into this presidency, the World Trade Towers are blown up and a plane is crashed into the Pentagon, what, 9 months after the inauguration or so. How did, if at all, how did that change the dynamic in that first term in the White House?
Well, it transformed it. It completely changed things. Suddenly, Cheney was the preeminent advisor. He was always very important. But as you said, his national security background made him the one that Bush wanted to lean on the most. In fact, when they decide to go into Iraq, President Bush is sitting there with all the people around the table. He's got this intel saying they think they know where Hussein is. And then he kicks everybody else out. And it's only him and Cheney in the room when they make the decision, when he makes the decision to go ahead and begin the war.
Is that unusual for a president and a vice president?
Vice presidents, I mean, the history of vice presidents is a pretty sorry history. I mean, they really haven't had much influence over time. John Adams, the first vice president, said, I am nothing and yet I may be everything. You know, Jack Garner said, who's FDR's vice president, that it's not worth a bucket of warm spit. And it wasn't until Walter Mondale that any office in the White House. So Cheney negotiated a very different deal for himself.
New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker has just published a book about the Bush-Cheney administration. It's called Days of Fire. Baker talked to our colleague Marcy Silman yesterday about the relationship between Bush and Cheney during the first term in office. Baker says Bush relied on Cheney's expertise then, particularly when it came to foreign policy. Today, Baker picks up the story after the 2004 election. The relationship between Bush and Cheney had shifted.
I think with Iraq, that you see a turning point. As the war goes bad, as they discover there are no weapons, as Bush begins to look ahead and say, what is my second term going to be about? He begins moving in a different direction than Cheney. He wants to try more diplomacy. He's shaving some of the harshest edges off of some of the terrorism programs that are so controversial. And he elevates Condoleezza Rice to Secretary of State, sort of his new preeminent advisor.
One thing that I hadn't known before reading this book was that Cheney actually went to President Bush and offered to be removed from that 2004 ticket.
Right. It's interesting, right? He says you might want to run with somebody else. Bush does think about it. He takes several weeks to think about it. He even comes up with a possible replacement, Senator Bill Frist of Tennessee. And the reason why he gives later for why he thought about it is interesting and revealing. He says because that would show who's really in charge. And that tells you how sensitive he had become, how much he was bristling at this idea that Cheney was really the man running things. It really began to gnaw at him and eat away at him.
What about Condoleezza Rice? She was elevated to Secretary of State, but what we also hear a lot of myths about her relationship with Bush.
Sure. Right.
And I get the sense reading your book that some of those were sort of true.
Well, they were very close in a different way. And I interviewed both Cheney and Rice, and Cheney said, look, we're not buddies, meaning him and the president. They didn't socialize together. But Rice did. She went to the mansion and had dinner on Sunday nights with the president and first lady. She worked out with the president. They talked sports. They went to Camp David. She really was a personal friend as well as a professional advisor. And that was the difference that she between her and Cheney.
I also get the sense, as you describe him, of a man, George Bush, who had a lot of loyalty to acquaintances and friends in particular, people that he brought with him from his Texas administration, people that he turned to. Even if he was just upset or sometimes for official counsel, that loyalty really trumped anything else that he was thinking about in staffing that place.
It did, and sometimes to a fault, right? He picks Harriet Myers for the Supreme Court because he trusts her. He knows her, but nobody else does. And it turns out she didn't, when the White House lawyers go to prep her for her Senate hearings, it turns out she doesn't understand a lot of these issues that she's going to be asked about. She wasn't a constitutional scholar, and they think she's going to be crucified on the Hill. And that's actually what dooms her nomination, not the conservative backlash. Just like the same with Donald Rumsfeld. His advisors, even his family, tells him he needs it to make a change after 2004. Bush hangs on for two more years because he bristles at the idea that he should get rid of somebody who's been loyal to him.
And his family. But Condoleezza Rice, she was as loyal to Bush as he was to her, right?
Oh, yes, very much so.
I mean,
yes.
It was a mutual relationship.
Very much so. So close. At one point during a dinner party in Washington, she starts to refer to him as my husband and then catches herself. Obviously, she's not married. Nobody suggests anything untoward between the two, but they're so close, brother and sister-like, that it's a relationship unlike any other.
If 9/11 was the defining moment, perhaps of both terms, but definitely of the first term. Would you say that Hurricane Katrina is the defining moment of the second term?
Well, I think that and the Iraq War in general. And look, you can't overlook the financial crisis. So it's so many.
Now, all that.
Well, that's why we come up with the title Days of Fire. It comes from his second inaugural address where he refers to 9/11 as a day of fire. And the conceit of the title is, look, this was 8 years of crises, 8 years of days of fire.
There were at least a couple of Bush's own advisors, though, who talked about the days right after Hurricane Katrina as the lowest. They describe it as the lowest point of the
Certainly.
Administration.
Yeah.
And I wonder, maybe it's not a defining moment. Would you agree with the assessment that it was the lowest point of that second term?
I mean, it's certainly one of them, absolutely, because what it does is it destroys any reputation for effectiveness and competence. You know, it's after that that the public, you know, doesn't view him the same way anymore. He can't get that back, you know, and his second term popularity numbers never, ever recover after that. So I think that on top of Iraq just makes just heads his second term into such a terrible place where his domestic policies aren't going to go anywhere because nobody believes in him the way they once did.
But his numbers were never as high as the immediate days after 9/11.
No, never. In fact, a former aide goes to see him in Dallas after he's left the presidency, asks him kind of cheekily, so what was it like to be, you know, leave office as the most unpopular president? Bush pushes back and says, well, I was also the most popular president, which is true. He had been in 90% after 9/11, finished in the 20s or 30s, depending on the poll you look at. And that tells you about lost opportunity and sort of the kind of the Greek tragedy, Shakespearean nature of this administration.
Well, it's interesting because President Obama has said for the last 4.5 years that when he took office, he was saddled with a lot of the baggage that came out of the Bush administration. Let's just say financial crisis was top, Iraq war. And now we're seeing the NSA scandal. You document all that. Spying has its roots in the previous administration.
Absolutely. Look, there are very few issues we're debating today that don't have at least some roots in the Bush-Cheney years. And Obama basically had run against Bush's first term and inherited Bush's second term. And by that, I mean Bush himself had moderated a lot of the things before he left office, so his successor wouldn't overturn everything. And Obama, in fact, kept a lot of the policies that he inherited, like the surveillance policy that's come to light in the last few weeks.
You know, I rattled off in introducing you originally these financial crisis, longest war in American history, right. You know, 9/11 aftermath. What positive came out of this administration?
Well, there's, you know, a lot of things that President Bush can point to that just gets overshadowed by those kinds of things. From his point of view, tax cuts, which were mostly preserved except for the richest under Obama, so most of those still in place, no child left behind. The PEPFAR program is one of those places that actually both parties agree to. That's the AIDS program that gets drugs to people in Africa, the largest public health effort by the United States overseas ever. So, you know, there are a number of things like that, Medicare expansion to pharmaceutical drugs, that for any other president would have been, you know, important accomplishments, but he's going to have to explain those in the context of Iraq.
That legacy from President Bush, those are the things that his own conservative wing of his own party are pushing back at him on, right?
What's interesting is the Tea Party arguably has its roots in the Bush years as well. Bush wasn't a small government conservative. He was a big government conservative. He believed in a strong federal role in education, whereas the other part of the party believed in abolishing Department of Education. So, you know, there's kind of a reaction to his form of republicanism. They didn't like immigration reform, which he pushed. They didn't like the expansion of government. And they didn't like the expansion of the surveillance state or the aggressive foreign policy. And that's where the Republicans are divided today.
I wonder if in this day and age of constant observation by the media and everybody else who's watching 24-hour news and online sources of news or not news, whether any administration can really be successful or be given the room to experiment.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, Obama came in with so much hope. He was going to be a new figure, a transformative figure. And within about 2 years of him being in office, I remember sitting down with one of his aides. And he was very discouraged. And he says, you know, I've come to the conclusion that there's no such thing as a great president anymore. You can't be a great president, partly because of the environment around you, the opposition, the media, and the failures of any individual person who is president, who by nature is a flawed individual.
That's New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker. He spoke to our colleague Marcy Silman about his new book, Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House.